I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate. One doesn't often think of America as being the most philosophical country in the history of the world, but in his book, America the Philosophical, Carlin Romano claims just that. Critic at large of the Chronicle of Higher Education and literary critic of the Philadelphia Inquirer for 25 years, Mr. Romano argues that our pragmatic philosophical traditions, our natural skepticism, and even our popular culture make for a marketplace of ideas that far surpasses that of ancient Greece. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm pleased it brings Mr. Romano to the Leonard Lopate Show. Thank you very much for coming in.
Glad to be here.
So, how did you come to the conclusion that America is the most philosophical country in the history of the world, as you put it?
Yeah, well,
and you even say America is to philosophy what Italy is to art. Explain that.
Oh, I'm glad you like that sentence. Some people made fun of that sentence, or Switzerland is to skiing. Yeah, well, I think it is a pretty damn near perfect environment for the practice of philosophy. I haven't been around since the beginning of the world. Somebody asked me if I had been, but I read a lot of newspapers, watch a lot of movies, and take in a lot of information. And one of my comebacks at my bookstore talks has been, well, what do you think is the most philosophical culture in the history of the world? The answer I get back most frequently is ancient Greece. And I say, oh, that was a very diverse society with a lot of argument coming from different belief systems. I mean, a lot of Athenian citizens and slaves, and not too many Asians, not too many Native Americans, not too many Christians, obviously, yet. One of my arguments is that we have such a tremendously diverse society. We have so many different belief systems vying for the attention of people, particularly the young, who often change their minds. Mm-hmm. That's part of the argument. When people think we're not philosophical and ancient Greece is very philosophical, they're basically regurgitating cliches.
Well, what about Germany and France? No one mentions those two?
Well, I start out the book by sort of joking about France, the unassuming. And in my first part, my introduction, I actually do a lot of comparison of America with other cultures. And in fact, I build the case for America, the unphilosophical. The rest of the book is the undermining of that case. But you could say in Germany, traditionally, official philosophy, academic philosophy, has gotten more respect and attention, although I've learned that has waned in recent decades, partly because of the behavior of major philosophers like Martin Heidegger, who became a Nazi, and so on. You could say that there are cultures in which the philosophy professor is more respected than the philosophy professor is in the U.S., but to me, that's not the same as saying it's a more philosophical culture.
Mm-hmm. So then, basically, you're redefining what we think of as philosophy, then. So,
well, yeah, I am.
What do you
partly
consider to be philosophy, then?
Okay, fair question. There's a review that's going to run in the New York Times this Sunday on the cover of the book review that says, "Well, I kind of redefine philosophy in a nebulous way." I don't think it's nebulous. I think I'm pretty clear about it. I see it as a ever expanding practice of persuasion that has some fairly clear criteria, but not precise scientific criteria. There has to be evidence. There has to be argument. There has to be a sensible relation between argument and evidence. Your claims can't be screwy. There has to be sustained attention. There has to be openness to counter-argument, counter-examples, and so on. But the attempt to make that scientifically exact is crazy. Mm-hmm. Philosophy has never been scientifically exact in that way because different people are persuaded by different things.
But given what you just said then, does advertising then count as philosophy?
Well, it could if it met those criteria. I think advertising in general is not really open to counter-argument. It creates reactions. People react to it. But it's an interesting question. Take your standard advertisements in glossy magazines. They hardly have text anymore, right? You've got some well-muscled guy, say, in a Ralph Lauren ad. You're lucky if you even know it's a Ralph Lauren ad, right? The branding isn't even very good. So it seems to me advertising, if anything, has deteriorated as a form of communication of ideas. It's just branding.
Oh, but what about the idea of a very handsome man or a very beautiful woman, no text? Isn't there persuasion there? Isn't there a power of persuasion?
Sure. I guess the people who do those and the people who pay money for them think there is. I'm a little skeptical myself. I suppose the implicit argument is you can be cool like this guy or this woman if you purchase our product. But frankly, I don't think that message comes through to a lot of people.
I don't know about that. We'll have to debate that at a later time.
I wouldn't pay those ad page prices.
So why did you choose to write about this topic?
Well, I've always been very interested in philosophy and of the traditional kind. These days I'm going to bookstores and talking about philosophy as a gigantic tent. And then when my talk is over and I've signed a few books, I end up browsing the philosophy section for 2 hours. So that may say something about my thesis, too. But quite seriously, as a book editor and critic at the Philadelphia Inquirer, in my years as a critic at the Chronicle of Higher Education, I have received so many, many books that seem to me distinctively philosophical, powerfully philosophical, that are not by philosophy professors. Sometimes they're by journalists, sometimes they're by intellectuals in other fields. So slowly I came to realize that one of the great cliches that hangs over our culture, that we're a dumbed-down, unintellectual culture, the cliche of Richard Hofstadter, the cliche of Tocqueville, is basically wrong. And I started to gather evidence and try to build an argument from different directions.
So who is the audience for your book? Because you write in a very conversational style.
Thank
and you have
you.
A lot of you have a lot of pop references in your book. Wittgenstein, you call him the Elvis of philosophy.
Yes.
And you call William James and his famous siblings those Kennedys of culture. Mm-hmm. Or the neurasthenic
right.
Kennedys of culture. Was this try to make the book more accessible?
Yeah, well, you have to remember, I've been a journalist my whole life, so it's not as if I kind of ratcheted up in this book to try to write like a journalist. My whole career has been largely the attempt to write about serious topics in a lively and entertaining way. I mean, 25 years as literary critic at a general interest newspaper that was not the New York Times, did not have an audience quite that high. So you do a lot of tricks and handstands to try to keep people interested. Sometimes it's wordplay, sometimes it's metaphor. But I think the goal is not to dumb down as you're doing it. It's possible to write in an accessible way to entertain while still being accurate to what you're writing about.
So then what about our famously short attention spans as Americans and our obsession with crazy things like Kardashians and the lives of the rich and famous and also religious fundamentalism? What about that?
Okay. Well, I think they're different things. With the Kardashians, I'm not sure that there would be a march on Washington if people stopped covering them. I find it hard to believe that test marketing shows people want more Kardashian, still Kardashian. So I think in some ways that's just going with the flow by media people. With religious fundamentalism, it's actually something I address in the introduction because a lot of the books that have depicted America as a dumbed-down culture endlessly cite religious fundamentalism and lots of trashy aspects of culture together. I don't think religious belief systems are a part of America, the unphilosophical. I think they actually contribute to our culture. So I part ways with my old pal Hitchens on this. I don't think all the believers should be strung up. And I don't think they're crazy. I would say that you can't disprove a lot of religious belief because of the logical peculiarities of religious terms and concepts. So to my view, there ought to be a fairly friendly culture and a friendly conversation going on between religious believers and the secular when it's possible. Now, when the religious try to impose their beliefs on the secular, I'm with the secular. But I don't start from the attitude that people simply believing dumbs down the culture or makes it unphilosophical.
Now, you think we as a nation, we Americans, we have a passion for philosophy. And this is exemplified by sort of the success of books like The Simpsons and Philosophy and Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, which is a joke book.
Mm-hmm.
But Do you? But you think of these as these count as philosophy.
Well,
why and how?
I would say it differently. We don't have a passion for philosophy as it's traditionally depicted. You know, there aren't people lining up at 6 o'clock in the morning to buy copies of Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. You know, they're lining up at Apple. What I do think we have is what I call in the book a rude independence of mind. We like to think and challenge authority. We like to shove evidence at other people and say they're wrong. Well, one example I've used in a lot of the bookstore talks is that guy, the congressman who said you lie to Obama during
Joe
a state.
Joe Wilson of South Carolina.
Yeah. You know, so the punditocracy went crazy. Oh, the collapse of our deliberative democracy and so on. I actually have a different view. I think those sorts of moments fuel America the philosophical, not because a remark like that is philosophical itself, but it highlights how resistant we are to authority and propriety when we think somebody's wrong. Same thing when the Supreme Court justices are rolling their eyes, you know, at him in the State of the Union address. So that's not philosophy. Every delusional person on the street who can't tie together two sentences, that's not philosophy. But there's a kind of leaning toward the challenging of authority in our enormous free expression culture that does produce what I consider philosophy.
Now, you say the role of social critic is more acceptable for Americans than the role of philosopher. Why
I talk at one point, particularly when I'm talking about the work of Michael Walzer and an excellent book he did, The Company of Critics, that I think that's a more familiar usage for us. You know, philosophy and philosopher remain strange terms in our culture because sometimes they're very honorific and prestigious, and other times they make us think of somebody who needs to be walked across the street, needs to be chaperoned, told whether the light is red or green. So we mock philosophers, but we also, I think, in serious moments, ultimately respect people who have a capacious, you know, view of things and go in. You know, I sometimes describe philosophy as a discipline that doesn't take yes for an answer. You know, you need to move on to the next concept. Think about that. You need to move on to the larger context. That's not just done by philosophy professors.
So you say a philosopher critic must, quote, work from within a community's core beliefs rather than snipe from the rooftops.
Mm-hmm.
Elaborate on that.
Well, that is, you know, part of that discussion of Walzer, and I think I'm sort of retailing his view there. But I do agree with it. If you are not speaking the language of your listeners, you are not going to persuade anybody if you don't in some way share assumptions and values of the people you're trying to persuade. So I think one of the difficulties that the official academic philosophy profession in the United States has with getting any media attention or getting any attention whatsoever is that it uses this nomenclature which is completely foreign to ordinary people. They don't speak American English.
So how then? So let's move away from social critics. What about folks in the media, like talk show stars like Oprah Winfrey and Howard Stern? How do you see them bearing a resemblance to celebrity rhetoricians in ancient Greece?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would go case by case. You know, I try to include broadcasters in the book, and it's been interesting to me some of the reactions. So, you know, I talk about Bill Moyers, and people say to me, oh, yeah, well, he's philosophical. You know, but Charlie Rose or, you know, Howard Stern, well, it depends. You know, at moments, I think they can be. I mean, Howard Stern, I think, is less philosophical than Bill Moyers. But Oprah Winfrey, actually, I mentioned in my introduction, was touted by the Christian Science Monitor in an article as the greatest existential philosopher ever. Now, that sounds like they were joking and being irreverent toward her. Actually, the article was not that irreverent. She didn't write a big treatise like Jean-Paul Sartre. She didn't write Being in Nothingness. But a lot of her actual discussions with people and the sort of thinking she's put out is quintessentially existential. And she reached a much larger audience than Mr. Jean-Paul Sartre.
That's true. I'm speaking with Carlin Romano about his new book, America the Philosophical. So, Mr. Romano, you write that America differs from other countries philosophically in the, quote, messy flesh and blood engagement of ideas with reality. What were you referring to?
Well, there, I'm somewhat referring to the way in which a classical type of American thinking, pragmatism, jibes with the problem-solving activities of excuse me, of Americans that most people recognize. A number of people who have responded to the book have said, oh, it's pragmatism again. But pragmatism, you know, works in theory. It doesn't work in practice. Well, that was a funny line that an academic philosopher who wanted to attack pragmatism once said, but it's not true. Pragmatism does work in practice. What the pragmatist said, and these are the classic people, William James, Charles Peirce, and John Dewey, is that our actual concepts come out of our need to solve problems in life. That's how we organize our world. That's how we define our concepts, even if they're a little blurry. So I see a kind of nice fit, hand in glove, between the pragmatic mentality in the ordinary sense of Americans, I've got a problem, I want to solve it and move on to the next thing, and the actual theorizing about concepts that American philosophers have done.
Mm-hmm. So the book brings to life some of the great figures of American philosophy, the great white men, as you call them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe their personal lives to be important to our understanding of their ideas?
I do. I don't put this forth in a, I hope, simplistic way. You know, somebody grew up with his father slapping him and therefore he believed X. But what I try to do in my account of philosophers who have been seen as argument machines, I would say one example would be Robert Nozick at Harvard, that they changed in relation to their own personal life and so on. So Nozick, for instance, who actually went to the same high school I did in Brooklyn, I learned later in life, starts out as an extremely abstract thinker with somewhat curious premises. He's interested in clobbering his opponents with his arguments. He's very inventive. Later on, he meets a poet named Gertrude Schnakenberg, and his whole attitude toward the very idea of argument changes. He writes a book for the public in which he starts to criticize his earlier work in philosophy, that you shouldn't be trying to crush an opponent in philosophy. So that's one example. There are others where we see that people's ultimate beliefs in philosophy came out of their personalities in a way that Nietzsche suggested and Wittgenstein and many other people who are recognized as philosophers.
So you believe that – well, let me start the question differently. What is it about America's diversity that makes us philosophical?
Well, I would say it's the challenge that it puts to any person growing up, who am I going to be? In a lot of societies, and I've reported from many countries in the world, the question, who am I going to be, has very few answers. One or two role models, perhaps, maybe even only one. I was asked a wonderful question at a bookstore reading. Do you think people change their minds more in America than anywhere else? Is that part of your thesis? I thought that was interesting.
And, how did you answer that?
Well, my answer was, I mean, in, like the journalist I am, I thought 10 seconds and then I had an answer.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. I thought, well, if we're talking about people over 35 or 40, probably it's not true that people are changing their minds a lot. Most people become set in their ways here as in other countries. But then I thought, what about kids who are, from 8 to 25 in the United States as opposed to Peru or Russia or so on? And I found myself circling back to my thesis because I think the unbelievable diversity of belief systems we have in this country, when combined with our immense terrain of freedom of expression, makes it possible for kids to act, and when I say kids, teenagers going into college and so on, to access different systems. So, okay, not every day does a Mormon become a Lubavitcher or a Lubavitcher becomes a Christian or so on, but there's so much more of that churning here than in any place I can think of that it seems to me to support the idea that we do respond philosophically here.
And not to get overly political in the minute and a half that we have left, but is it possible for the politician to change his or her mind on one, say, core issue, but is it reasonable to believe that that person could change his or her mind on a whole host of issues, political issues, over the span of 5 years or so, and they're older than 25?
Sure.
They're older than 35.
I mean, we see examples. I mean, Romney seems able to do that.
Do you believe it?
No, I think probably he's not changing his mind because of philosophical argument or evidence. He's changing it because of strategic reasons in politics. But, you know, there's a wonderful old line or tale of John Maynard Keynes, the economist, you know, who once said to someone, you know, when the facts change, my opinions change. What do you do, sir? Yeah. Well, you know, I think people should change their minds if facts change, but, you know, you try to hold on to enduring principles, at least most people do.
Mm-hmm. We have less than a minute left, but I cannot let you go without asking you about Hugh Hefner.
Mm-hmm.
Can he really be called an American philosopher?
Hey, take a look at his picture. I worked very hard to get a photo of him in which he looks like Bertrand Russell. He's got the hat. He's got the pipe. But seriously, I think he can. Yeah, I think he had an enormous effect on civil liberties, on liberated notions of sexuality in the country. He wrote a whole gang of articles which were put together called The Playboy Philosophy. He's a more serious guy than most people realize. I did spend time with him. He's very articulate. Even coming back from a stroke, he's articulate. Good at counterexamples. Yeah, he likes to sleep with young blonde women, but he's also got a brain.
I've been speaking with Carlin Romano about his book, America the Philosophical, published by Knopf. And he will be in conversation with Simon Critchley tomorrow night at 7 at McNally Jackson. No,
that's in July, actually. Oh. July 19th.
July 19th at 52 Prince Street.
That's right.
Carlin, thank you so much
you
for joining
me.
Us today.
Okay.
Don't worry.
Okay.